I think this is an enormously important question. It's something I care a great deal about, and it perhaps is the most important question theologically. And I think you're right that he was caught between a rock and a hard place. But I think this has to do with the method he adopted, and which it, it sort of reflected in his claim. In his the argues at his inauguration that the student of the New Testament should be primarily a historian.
Welcome to the Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast, a show devoted to bridging the gap to the historic Reformed Christian faith. Listen in as two friends, a layman Nick and a pastor Peter, discuss the newest and best books in the broader Christian tradition with some of the most respected seminary and college professors, pastors, theologians, authors, and more. We hope these book club episodes introduce solid theological works to those who want to read but don't know where to start or who to trust. You'll be introduced to authors you know and many others you don't from various theological traditions, but all under the broader tent of our shared creedal tradition. All of these authors and books help us to do the same thing. They remind us of how the finished work of Jesus Christ changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by the Davenant Institute's educational arm, Davenant Hall. Interested in dipping your toes at Davenant Hall this upcoming Trinity term from April 8th to June 15th? Registration closes March 29th. Here's a taste at the courses. 1st and 2nd Corinthians with Joshua Shaw, The Mercy of God in Scripture and Tradition with Ryan Hurd, Male and Female in Modernity with Alistair Roberts, Introduction to Syriac and Arabic Theology with Charles Carman, Philosophy as a Way of Life with Joe Minich, Aristotle Seminar 1, Ethics and Metaphysics with Tim Jacobs, Early Christian Worship, Ritual and Space in the Ancient Church with Matthew Hoskin, Reformation of the Modern World with Michael Lynch, Christian Epic in Old English Literature with Anthony Cirilla, Moral Theology for Counseling with Jim Pachta, Anglican Polity with Nathaniel Keane, and Philosophy of Law with Colin Redemer. GGG listeners who are first-time Davenant Hall students get a $25 discount on auditing any of their Trinity term courses from April 8th to June 15th. Registration closes March 29th with code GGGTrinity24, which is in our show notes. Go to www.davenanthall.com to sign up. Hey, this is Peter Bell, and I am in the beautiful wine country of Central Coast, California, in Santa Maria, north end of Santa Maria, in Santa Barbara County. I serve Redeemer OPC, Redeemer Orthodox Presbyterian Church, on the north end of Santa Maria. We meet at Temple Bethel, which is right there, Temple Bethel, at 11 a.m. for Sunday service and 9:45 a.m., so just before that, for Sunday school. For all ages, we have kids Sunday school, adult Sunday school, or all Sunday school at 9:45. You can find us at discoverredeemer.org with one R. Again, discoverredeemer.org. We have a bunch of activities throughout the week, but most importantly, Sunday, we have the gospel preach, the sacraments administered, and church discipline faithfully brought out. So I hope to see you here at Redeemer OPC in Santa Maria, Central Coast, wine country of Santa Barbara. Hope to see you.
Hey everybody, this is Pastor Danny Hyde from the Oceanside United Reformed Church. I want to invite you out to our church. We meet in sunny Southern California, here in San Diego, and we meet at the Army Navy Academy in Carlsbad, right along the ocean, as you can see, the Pacific. And we meet every Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning. We hear the Word of God, we hear the Gospel preach, we have the Lord's Supper every Sunday morning, and then we have Sunday school at about noon for kids. We come again together at 5 o'clock every night, Sunday night, for teaching, prayer, and singing. And then we also have various midweek groups, Bible studies, men's, women's, and also other Bible studies as well throughout the week. So I want to invite you out to worship with us. If you know anybody in the area here in North County of San Diego, invite them as well. Let them know. You can find out more about us on our website, oceansideurc.org, or also on all those various social media to find us as well. God bless.
Hey, this is Peter, one of the co-hosts. We're doing something new. All ads will be fronted before the episode for unimpeded listening pleasure. A quick plug for our show, Guilt, Grace, Gratitude. Would you consider giving to our show? We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so your donations are now tax deductible. We've got two options to give. One, email us at guiltgracepod@gmail.com if you'd like to send a check or use our direct donor link. Or two, go to our show notes and click on our donor box link to give a recurring donation or a one-time gift. You can also click on our Patreon account in the show notes and sign up for monthly exclusives, merchandise, coupon codes with publishers we work with, giveaways for our subscribers, and much more. All donations we're gifted are used exclusively to pursue our mission to bridge the gap to reform Christian theology. Would you join us? Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone. Yet once again, it's another day of fresh grace and mercy. This is the Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast, where we bridge the gap to reformed Christian theology for your listening pleasure. Today's book club episode is brought to us by Erdmann's Publishers. Our good friends at Erdmann's provided us the copy of this book today and set up the interview with Richard Burnett. The book that we're going to be talking about that Richard Burnett wrote is Machen's Hope, A Transformation of a Modernist in the New Princeton. And here's for their YouTube audience what it looks like. The foreword is by Mark Knoll. We've had him on the show before. So we're definitely going to ask him some questions about this book. And we just recently, as a lot of the audience might know, we recently hit the 100th anniversary of Machen's most popular book, Christianity and Liberalism. So there's a renewed interest and introduction out there about Machen. So this comes on a good timing. So we'll get to know and remind people who Machen was and why his works were so important and why we still talk about him. And yes, he's not alive anymore. So we will talk about that a little bit more. So as you guys know, I held up my new coffee mug when I said my little catchphrase. That's exciting because this is only the second episode now that we have on merch that we're showing off. When you go to our website, guiltgracepod.com, there's a store on there, a little store link and a shop link. I think it's called shop. And you could get t-shirts, mugs, stickers, maybe some other things. But I think we're keeping it kind of simple and light for you for you guys. And we are a nonprofit. So these donations come to us to help, you know, keep our mission moving forward so we can serve the world. Sharing the gospel through the airwaves, sharing it through the podcast apps and the YouTube. So speaking of that, if you go to our YouTube page, it's pretty simple. You just type in the name of our podcast in YouTube. It's a pretty simple platform to use. And then you hit subscribe. You can like and comment on things. And then obviously rate and review our podcast apps too. That really helps keep the algorithm high where, you know, this could be found by others a little bit easier out there. This day and age, there's a ton of podcasts, so, and there's a lot of great ones, but we definitely want to do our job in promoting and making sure people hear our content. So also, if anyone out there is looking for a church to call home, we have a little NAPARC church finder. Click that. It'll help you out. And then, you know, if you want to engage with us more, if in between episodes, you're like, you know, what do they have going on? What do they talk about? You know, on a day-to-day basis, Twitter, we're the most active on, and say it's usually Peter is really active on Twitter. And so you can check out kind of, you know, what we are, talking about daily on there. And then Instagram, I, kind of run the Instagram page. And mainly highlight our episodes that we have on Mondays and Thursdays. And then, yeah, and I already talked about YouTube. And then our email address is guiltgracepod@gmail.com. If you just want to keep it old school and just want to shoot us an email and ask us a question, that works too. And like I said, we're a nonprofit 501c3. So if you are, all our donations can be tax deductible. So we can talk about how that is as well. But we'll get into this conversation with Richard Burnett. I'll let Peter further introduce him today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to introduce our audience, Richard Burnett, who's executive director and managing editor of Theology Matters. He's an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA and was formerly professor of systematic theology at Theological Seminary. His previous books include Karl Barth's Theological Exegesis, The Hermeneutical Principles of the Römerbrief Period. I'm trying to bring out my German, which is non-existent on that one. But it's a pleasure having you on the show, Dr. Burnett.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Yeah. We share a little, both some love for Machen, but I grew up in the PCUSA in Southern California. It was the conservative branch of the PCUSA before there were some quibbles in our presbytery in the 2000s. But yeah, I grew up in it. So I know it well. So this would be fun. So yeah, let's first start off with letting our listeners know, beyond just the work that you do for Theology Matters and some of your books, let's get to know Richard Burnett. So let our audience get to know Richard Burnett a little bit more.
Well, I've been very blessed in my life. I'm a child of the covenant. Had the great blessing of being raised in a Christian home by two very loving and sincere Christians who took the vows of my baptism. They raised me in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And so I grew up, I feel enormously privileged. I was born in West Virginia. We didn't have a lot of money. Moved to Charlotte, North Carolina when I was about nine. And but I've always felt like the beneficiary of a great heritage as a Presbyterian. And my father was a Presbyterian minister, and my older brother's a Presbyterian minister. And I grew up surrounded by people who cared about me. And my father served two middle-class congregations. And so I have a lot of wonderful memories as a pastor's kid. And I grew up in a great theological tradition, part of a caring community. Mm-hmm. People, and actually a community that made a difference in the world. I mean, they built hospitals and schools and colleges and seminaries, and many of them, you know, lived the Christian life, and I witnessed that growing up. And so they poured a lot of love into me, and I they gave me opportunities to study. And so I became a minister and served congregations in Tennessee and New Jersey and North Carolina, South Carolina. So I have a great debt of gratitude for these people. They're my people. And a sense of responsibility for them. So yeah. I've been married for 36 years to the same woman. We've got four kids and three grandchildren. So
nice.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I'm the director of the Master of Arts in Reformed Theology program at Dubuque Seminary.
Oh, you know, okay. Dubuque. Yep. Yep.
So I wear different hats.
I like it.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So onto this book. You even talk about this in your introduction, like why another biography on Gresham Machen? Because there's two really solid biographies, Stonehouse's and D.G. Hart's on J. Gresham Machen. So what are you doing in this biography that either differs from their biographies or builds upon them? Talk about this biography amidst the other biographies that have been written on them.
Well, I tried to give more attention to Machen's intellectual context at Johns Hopkins and at Princeton and in Germany, as well as his cultural and ecclesial contexts. And, you know, many try to interpret Machen, you know, primarily as a Southerner or as a Southern Presbyterian or as an old school Presbyterian, whereas a representative of old Princeton, and there's some truth in all of that, all of these claims, but he's much more complex, and I think it's a mistake to try to explain him in light of just one or even a combination of these. I mean, he's a much more complex person, and so, you know, what I've written is what they call an intellectual biography. Uh-huh. And it falls in that category because I trace the development of his ideas. And I do so in light of a lot of private correspondence. I think at least half or more of the letters haven't been published before. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big difference. It's the ones I read before. I think Stonehouse relies a little bit more on some of the letters, and Hartz is a little bit more of just kind of a general biography. But yeah, there's a lot more interaction with his private letters with his mom, with other ministers, with other academics, whatever it may be, which is really interesting to read Machen in his own words and your context around that.
Yeah. And like any biography or learning about somebody, you got to talk about their childhood. So let's talk about Machen's childhood a little bit. How did his parents and his education at Johns Hopkins form and shape his outlook, his intellectual life, especially in his regards to how that formed his work in the seminary later on?
Well, he grew up in a very prominent family. Mm-hmm. And both his parents were exceedingly bright and high-minded, well-educated, cultured, sophisticated, intellectual types of folks. And they cared, and I think I say at some point, they cared deeply about the Christian faith and about the finer things of life. And I think pretty consistently in that order. I mean, they did care deeply. They were deeply Christian people. And Arthur was an attorney. His dad, Arthur Sr. was a prominent attorney in Baltimore. And he and his wife, Mary, and she went by Minnie. Mm-hmm. They were highly driven, hard charging, working, hardworking individuals who, they were part of an elite social class in Baltimore, and were surrounded by, you know, some of the brightest, most educated and influential citizens in America. I mean, they were leaders in this community, movers and shakers, you'd call them today, not only in Baltimore, but in Washington, D.C. And so they had this broad social network of, it included, you know, senators and congressmen and governors, you know, presidents of universities, bankers, academicians, business leaders. So a really, they'd be called today, I guess, a power couple.
Okay. Yeah.
And she reminds me of sort of in some aspects of Scarlett O'Hara. Do you all know that reference?
That's vague. I'm not sure, but vague.
Is this big movie called Gone with the Wind?
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. That's where I'm from.
Right. But she's not, you know, it's just, you know, a rich Southern socialite. She's a bright woman.
Intellectual heavyweight.
Yeah, she's very serious. But she's what we call here in the South a steel magnolia. Do you know that?
I have heard of that. Yep, I have heard of that.
So, yeah. You know. So she's very a gracious hostess and charming conversationalist and diplomatic organizer and all that. A Southern lady, but she's a force to be reckoned with, had strong literary ambitions. Mm-hmm. And In many ways, she's a modern woman in some ways, rather somewhat surprisingly. In fact, there's Catherine Van Drunen, and
yep,
you
I know,
may know
that's David Van Drunen's wife.
Yep.
Yeah, she wrote a wonderful dissertation about.
Yeah, I've read it. It is phenomenal.
Yeah, and you know, and she sort of says, makes that case, and she says Mary, Minnie Mason, was the undisputed spiritual leader in the home. I'm not sure about that, but she was. And back to your question, Nick, and no doubt. I mean, she inculcated what was most important to her, and catechizing her boys, and left an indelible mark on them. And it's fascinating. She goes through a crisis of faith herself, like a lot of Southern folks after the war, and the Civil War, and not least because of reckoning with part of what the South had stood for, namely slavery. And, her father, this is Machen's grandfather, James Jones Gresham, was, had hundreds of slaves. Hmm. And so I think Minnie Machen, has a deep sense of guilt about that. Hmm. And horror. I mean, she saw it up close and personal, slavery. Hmm. And so, she writes a poem about it and suggesting that, this is God's judgment, what's happened to us. And Arthur, very different. I mean, Arthur's 21 years older than Minnie. And he's a Harvard graduate. Studies law, extremely well read. He teaches himself Greek, mm-hmm. and reads the New Testament classics, and his own theological journey is fascinating. He's interested in modern biblical scholarship, and including German scholarship, and not opposed to in principle to higher criticism. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't make a profession of faith until later, when he's sort of more settled. He's an Episcopalian, mm-hmm. I think, until he marries Minnie. But I think, if I recall, he wants part of the Episcopal prayer book. They part of their wedding service. So he's still in some ways, in terms of sensibilities, an Episcopalian.
Yeah,
becomes a Presbyterian elder and a very faithful one. But he's 54 years old when his middle son, Gresham, John Gresham, is born. And Machen grows up with his dad sort of older. And he describes his dad as a profoundly Christian man. And still waters run deep, he says at one point. And I think the most thing that I remember is, he says, he was not of the don't touch, don't handle, don't taste, attitude. So he's he's open minded. And so that's the family. And Nick, I think you meant about Johns Hopkins. Yes.
Yeah.
Has just a profound impact. Yeah. I mean, this is
he grew up like right next door to Johns Hopkins, too.
That's right. It's hard to overestimate the significance of that. And this is where his hope is a significant part of his hope is born. And he the founding of Johns Hopkins in 1876 has an enormous consequences. It's the first truly modern. It's also research driven university in America. So it's modern. And Machen sees this as a revolution. The whole country, sees this in higher education as a revolution. And Machen identifies with this very deeply. In fact, he, like Gilman, the president, he suggests that, the nation, the United States, was born in 1776. This is another revolution in 1876 that may be as significant. So And so Machen identifies with this revolution, and you know, so he extols these university ideals, and he places a great deal of hope in them, and also in the future of American universities, and a number of reasons for that. And he gives this, he talks about this, it he writes about it. He gives an address to a German Verbindung, and he becomes a member of, and yeah, and so it's like a fraternity, but you know, more, a lot more structured.
Yeah,
yeah, and so he publishes this address in German, in a German publication, and for some reason this was never translated, and so it's in the book.
Yep,
and,
it's like the appendix of the book. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's, I think it's pretty significant just in it giving yeah, a sense of what he was thinking. So he puts a great deal of hope in these ideals. Please feel free to interrupt me. I mean, to talk, you know, if you have questions about anything.
No, this is good. This sets up the rest of it. Because like what you said, his time at Johns Hopkins and his childhood under Minnie, his mother, and Arthur, his father, and just how intellectually stimulating it was, and especially with Johns Hopkins, building upon that, a lot of his educational aspirations are born there. And then you can see he's wrestling with a lot of that stuff as he's going through Princeton Seminary, Princeton Universities in Germany. Like it really sticks with him for the rest of his life. And he's we'll talk about kind of a lot of his crisis. It's not what people think his crisis is. It's has much more to do with his like academic aspirations and what he's trying to do.
Yeah. Question too, to tag on if you don't mind. And then Peter, feel free to jump in. This is actually a good question. I think just for the audience too, that inspirationally Minnie was such a great mother with the catechisms and the teaching young Machen what he needed to do. So it starts the childhood, you know, putting this education forward. As Presbyterians, we have great childhood educational tools. I don't know if you know if Minnie used a specific one. I know the Westminster Shorter Catechism and
the
Westminster
Shorter.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's something to point out just for the audience to be like, because a lot of people I know that are outside, especially the Reformed faith, are like, that don't know about these teaching tools for kids, are like, well, how can I do that for my kid? So I just wanted to tee that up there and dangle it for you guys to say, yeah, way to introduce the Westminster Shorter Catechism or whatnot.
Well, Nick, I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, when I talked about my own background and I mean, one of my earliest memories I have as a little kid is saying my catechism to one of the reading elders. And I remember in that day, I don't know if you remember, they put little stars on your page, you know, these little, and he had big pancake hand, put that star. And I mean, I remember that as a little kid.
So. Yeah. It sticks with you for sure. Yeah, literally. Excuse the pun.
did Machen have, if I'm not missing, didn't he have the whole Shorter Catechism memorized by the time he was like 10 or 11, whatever it was? He was young whenever he had it memorized. His mom pushed him, which he was used to that rigor, which was, yeah.
The thing is, everybody did it.
He wouldn't have been the exception. He would have been the rule.
Right. I mean, you would have been odd if you hadn't done that. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, catechizes all three of his daughters, you know, so this is not exceptional. This is
true,
the rule.
True. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think it's what, up until the last statistic I heard is like up until 100-ish years ago, that was the rule. It's like you catechize your kids and they had it memorized by the time they're 11, 12, 13, sometime before high school, they had it memorized.
Most of the adults over 65 years old in the Presbyterian Church still remember that.
Yep, that's what I've heard. It's the same thing in the Dutch Reformed Church, as most of them still have the Heidelberg memorized down flat. It's pretty astonishing. Mm-hmm. So moving on with this, and this is good groundwork. And you touch on this, and this does kind of find its theme, its thread throughout this book. Because I think what's so often assumed is Machen had some crisis of faith after Johns Hopkins, after Princeton. He goes to Germany. He's trying to figure out, well, I want to be a scholar. I got to get my PhD. I'm not really sure what to do with this. And it's assumed when he goes to Germany, he has this big crisis of faith. And you said there's like there might be something to this. Studying under higher critical scholars has returned to the States. But you bring a different perspective to the conversation, that it's not quite a crisis of faith that he's going through. Can you talk about what is he dealing with in Germany that's not quite questioning his faith, but not necessarily separate from it?
Well, it's very complex. And I mean, it takes a long time to get at it and different aspects of it. But I mean, his crisis of faith and the torturing doubt, I think Stonehouse talks about it. It has to do with, vocational struggles as well, but they have a great deal to do with his efforts to live out these modern university ideals.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do at Princeton Seminary. I mean, he does not think Princeton Seminary's faculty is sufficiently serious about modern biblical scholarship.
That was the most, if I could just interject, that was the most surprising part of the book. I had always heard Princeton was like the elite of the elites, and then reading the book is like, that's not what Machen thought.
No, I mean, he explicitly didn't. He thought Moorfield was too churchly and not.
I was so surprised reading this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. His experience in Germany was something he always spoke of it with enormous fondness. And it made it enormous impact. I mean, he told his parents, it was the breath of life to me. And so his encounter now with Hermann was deeply unsettling. But that was, that was the case with almost most of Hermann's students. I mean, Hermann's faith was, vibrant. And it was like nothing he had ever encountered.
No.
And that really made him question a lot.
That shook him. Yeah, that's not for the audience. It's not because his vibrant faith is what questioned Machen. It was Machen was like, where do you get this faith from if it's not from supernatural revelation?
Hmm. Right. And that's when he begins to question his own faith.
Yeah.
Not that he didn't have doubts before. I mean, he admits, and do y'all know Daryl Hart?
Daryl? Oh,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, Daryl agrees, that, the doubts were even before Germany.
Yeah.
So, in fact, Daryl claims that Hermann makes him have to reexamine his faith. And that without Hermann, Machen might not have been possible for Machen to enter into the ministry. And I think Daryl's right about that. But I don't think it's right. I don't think it was a mystery seminary's instruction, I think Daryl says something like, Machen failed to appreciate the seminary's instruction. And that's a mystery. I don't think it's a mystery. I mean, he just didn't think they were.
He think it was hard. Yeah. He was like, this is not very good.
Right. I mean, they're just not taking the results of historical criticism seriously enough.
And, yeah, which is what you say, why I think it's so important to really put a point on Johns Hopkins, because he was used to very rigorous academic research.
Right. I mean, and so he wasn't, Johns Hopkins, he was already introduced. He knew about historical criticism, higher criticism, and all that. So Germany isn't where he learned that for the first time by any means.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think it dispels a lot of stuff, but it's also his crisis is not so much his faith. It's he's dealing with how do we introduce critical scholarship within a vibrant faith? Like, what does this look like? You can tell. I mean, we'll get into it, but you can tell there's a lot of struggle once he goes back to Princeton, because he went to Princeton as a graduate. but it's so interesting. Like, it's much more multifaceted than even I thought coming into this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yes, I mean, Machen often struggled with his calling, which we can, a lot of us can relate to. So it's actually kind of helpful to hear that. So we can relate to him and what he's struggling with, and it humanizes him a little bit. So, feeling a pull, he was feeling a pull towards the academy, and weirdly enough, he didn't quite fit in. So maybe you can talk about that, into that guild aspect. But he is also conflicted about the ministry. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, he does really think about being a professor of classics. He thinks about teaching in a university career, that kind of thing. That is in the back of his mind again and again and again. So, so his friend is sort of like an older brother, William Armstrong, who he calls Army, and he's a Southerner too, but he's extremely bright, incredible scholar. Doesn't publish a great deal, but he's a remarkable scholar. And he and Machen, Army convinces him to try it out for a year. And he's still dithering. I mean, he's not sure what he wants to do, but he's testing the waters. Mm-hmm. And so he tries to, with Armstrong, they try to see if they can raise the bar, raise the standards of biblical scholarship at Princeton Seminary. And they try to introduce, or get students up to speed when it came to, modern historical biblical scholarship. And so, and they wanted students, not merely students, to take, the results of modern biblical scholarship seriously. And and that's tricky business, mm-hmm. very tricky business at Princeton Seminary at that time. And they got plenty of pushback, they didn't know, if the board of directors, or a significant number of alumni, or even the administration was going to come down on them. And so, it's wondering, can I be honest? Can I be, is this possible to do this? And that's a major reason why Machen is wary of joining the faculty.
Mm. Yeah, I keep on saying this, Judith, there's no other word. He was a student there, so he's already aware of their academic capability, especially with the relationship with Princeton University. Mm. And that's an interesting relationship even on its own. How does the seminary and the university, how do they relate to one another? And Machen's his sympathies don't necessarily lie with the seminary. They tend to align with the university, even though he's at the seminary. And there's a changing relationship or landscape of evangelicalism, all the while he's looking into starting at the seminary, and he's continuing there, and he's looking at Princeton. He's looking at all these other universities, modernizing their approach. So what are some of the issues now that we're at Princeton? So we've gone from his childhood to Johns Hopkins, a little bit through Germany after Princeton, he's back at Princeton. What are some of the issues he's facing at Princeton? Because he doesn't get along with the board of directors all that often, and he's not a huge fan of the presidents that they're bringing over to Princeton. So yeah, talk about his relationship with Princeton Seminary and also Princeton's with the university.
Well, I mean, I think he originally, when he goes in 1902 to Princeton Seminary, he has high hopes that,
yeah,
because of Woodrow Wilson, who is
a true
John Hopkins, and who's a family friend. I mean, the Machen family, and I mean, they go way back. And he has hopes that Woodrow Wilson's reforms of the university will have will be very, very positive, and that hopefully that's going to roll over and spur the seminary to get up to speed.
Yeah.
And so Machen, on the one hand, is trying to raise the bar, modern biblical scholarship at the seminary, and trying to abuse critics from the outside you know, especially at the university, and you know, that yeah, the seminary does care about scholarship, because the seminary is being ruthlessly belittled. I mean, it just is intense by the press and by universities, professors, and at other universities, not just Princeton, as being a bunch of troglodytes. You know, and they're fighting. They said, you guys are just always fighting these wars of Canaan. That's what the university people tell about the seminary. You know, you're bludgeoning each other with clubs. So Machen's trying to make a case, you know, no, we're interested in scholarship. On the other hand, Machen is seeing that Protestant liberals and even more radical people are gaining ascendancy in higher education.
Yep.
And we're beginning to exercise their power openly.
Yep.
I mean, they had been in power for a long time.
But, yep. Yeah. But now they're exercising it a lot more openly.
Yeah. And so the relationship between the seminary and the university has been strained for generations. I mean, the seminary is founded because of a strain with a relationship with the college.
1812. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a very important history to understand about that relationship, just how that happened and then the trajectory. But the relationship was really broken and probably beyond repair by the time, even before Machen even set foot on campus.
Yeah.
And I think the same goes for the old Princeton and the Presbyterian Church. You know, old Princeton lost the battle over confessional revision in 1902. It was a decisive defeat for old Princeton, and it demonstrated that it no longer had sway in the denomination. So the Presbyterian Church was, you know, clearly going in a different direction. And, you know, and despite, you know, votes in the General Assemblies in 1910, 1916, things were going, you know, there was already this division opening up.
Yeah, and that brings up a good point and highlight that Machen was instrumental in founding the Orthodox Presbyterian Church denomination, as we many of us already know. So speaking of that, he was a scholar. He has some of his academic works, like we talked about Christianity and Liberalism.
That was his popular work. Yeah. His academic works are a little different. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, we just hit the 100th anniversary of his most popular work, Christianity and Liberalism, as probably a majority of the audience would know of. But there are more academic works out there. He didn't just write that book. He wasn't just the founder of the OPC. So how were his academic works received by the academics of his time?
Well, Christianity and Liberalism, he wrote a lot of popular works. I mean, he was a serious New Testament scholar. He's a fine scholar, and a good historian of the Greco-Roman world. You know, he kept up with German biblical scholarship for a long time. And, you know, he was an excellent grammarian. I mean, I remember using it in college.
His Greek textbook.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, you know, he's a clear thinker and writer and a gifted communicator. And the origin of Paul's religion is, you know, arguably, you know, his best academic work. I mean, the Virgin Birth is the other one that's major. And he worked on that almost his whole life. Since he had undergraduate days, he'd begin work on something on the Virgin Birth. But you know, the origin of Paul's religion is a very credible piece of scholarship. I mean, I devote several pages, I think, to its reception. And, you know, of course, conservatives regard it as a tour de force. But even liberals acknowledge it as being good learned.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, none disputed its erudition.
No.
English reviewers were particularly grateful that he was able to assimilate so much German scholarship, and even German scholars had some nice things to say about it. I think one of the most interesting is Adolf Jülicher, who he had as a teacher and who he admired, wrote and said that, you know, the work was distinguished by its thoroughness or something like that. And anyway, it was a compliment. And even the young Rudolf Bultmann had a nice thing or two to say about it. But the critics in America and Germany pointed to deeper, more basic methodological problems that I discuss at a considerable length.
Yeah,
but I think you're right. He was a formidable scholar and had a real gift for making complex things often very clear.
Mm-hmm. He did, yeah. So he's also caught. We've talked about this a little bit, and I want to push into this a little bit more. Call it the rock and a hard place. So he employed the methods of higher critical scholars. We've talked about that at length. And maybe that rubs against our listeners a little bit who don't like higher critical scholarship. And I'm not a huge fan of a lot of their results, but a lot of their methods are pretty solid. And he's also deeply conservative and orthodox in his theology. So he's caught flack from both sides. He catches flack from the conservatives for utilizing higher critical scholarship and from the higher critical scholars for being too supernatural in his look. And he trusts the scriptural witness. So can you describe, this is from what, the 1910s up until mid 1920s ish when the trial happens and he's somewhat defrocked and then goes over and founds Westminster, which you don't talk about in the book necessarily. But can you talk about his, like, where does he fit between conservatives of his day and Protestant liberals of his day? Because it doesn't seem like he fits neatly on one side or the other.
I think this is an enormously important question. It's something I care a great deal about. And it perhaps is the most important question theologically. And I think you're right that he was caught between a rock and a hard place. But I think this has to do with the method he adopted.
Yeah.
And it's sort of reflected in his claim, in his he argues at his inauguration that the student of the New Testament should be primarily a historian.
Yep.
Now that has implications.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I write a lot about this. Yep. And I think it's a very important matter. And I think Machen struggled. I think he continued to struggle with this at various levels. But that whole discussion is really a deeper systematic theological matter. And it has to do with, the relationship between religion and science, with faith and history.
Yep.
Reason and revelation.
Yep. This happens during the Monkey Scopes trial in the 1920s. And so he's dealing with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but it's a deeper systematic issue that he tries to work out. And I think, I think he was wrestling with that to the end.
Yeah, he was. Even at, if I have this right, was it Princeton University where they brought over Billy Sunday and a few others of the kind of fundamentalist evangelicalism, and Machen's like, what are you guys doing? This is, and he, like, I think he went to it. He's like, this is some of the worst stuff I've ever heard in my entire life.
You know, that's sort of a critical moment. He slowly begins to wake up to what's happening in the academy.
Yeah.
I mean, he starts to see it, but that's sort of a watershed moment for him. And it's like Psalm 78, like a warrior roused from a drunken stupor. He starts to wake up.
Yep. Yep.
And to what's going on. And, so it is an important time for him.
Yeah. And he also listens to Protestant liberal scholars. And he's like, this is no better because they deny the supernatural and it's become psychologized a la William James and all those people. And he's like, this is no better. Like he's almost like, where do I go if I'm looking for deep scholarship that's also deeply orthodox?
And you can tell he kind of feels like a nomad in some sorts.
Yeah, we can sometimes relate, right? a lot of times. That actually is a perfect tee up to this last question. As we conclude, just talking about the hope you have, Dr. Burnett, of what people what you want people to get out of reading Machen's Hope, this book, this biography of him that you so well put together with Erdman's help. What's your overall hope? And, you know, the hope that, how do you hope this forms our perception of who Machen himself was as a person? And, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. We're dealing with a lot of the same issues that he addressed and faced with as well today, you know, even being caught between a rock and a hard place individually on some of these matters. So what is kind of your overall hope based on those things from this book?
Yeah. Well, I hope readers will gain a deeper understanding and appreciation of what was happening in America in the late 19th, 20th centuries, intellectually and spiritually. And I hope readers will gain a deeper understanding and appreciation of what Machen was trying to overcome. I mean, he was right about so much about liberalism.
Mm-hmm. He was dead on.
I mean, its emphasis on theory, praxis over theory, and expense of doctrine, and social transformation, expense of spiritual transformation, and the subjectivism that, my personal truth games and all that, there's a danger on the other side of sort of a false objectivism. That's part of the legacy of, I think, Scottish common sense realism. But, he was right about so much, and nobody in America, challenged Protestant liberalism as vigorously. And I think few saw more clear the power and the attraction of it. And I think he tried to sound the alarm, but I think Protestant liberalism was, and it is, a far more complex, more powerful and deeply rooted phenomenon than Machen realized. Or perhaps anybody in Machen's day realized. And so, I think that, that is something that I think we need to continue to think through, because Protestant liberalism is not dead.
No.
I mean, the mainline Protestants are denominations are dying, no doubt about that. But
big time dying, yeah.
Yeah, but Protestant liberalism is still very powerful in terms of its ideas have wide currency. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how you explain wokeism apart from some of the antecedents of Protestant liberalism. Its ideas have wide currency among a lot of conservative and evangelicals I know, the kids of the, at least. So it's still something we need to think hard about and try to understand. And Machen warns you, not to just think you can ignore it.
Kind of the conservative shtick, which is stick your head in the mud and hope everything passes by.
No, can't do it. I mean, he sees that very clearly. So I think it's a very important question. As far as how we deal with it today, I think it's enormously important. And I think trying to understand and appreciate each other's questions and concerns, and I think trying to interpret even those we disagree with according to, their strongest arguments, not just their weakest arguments.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty important. And I think trying to be open and just willing to listen and to talk with one another is I think that's one way forward, which is why I appreciate your invitation today.
Of course. Yeah. And it does remind me of what Machen did, because Machen wasn't like, let's lead the conservative charge against the Protestant liberals and fight back harder and just call them names. It's like, no, we got to produce better scholarship if we want to win this theological war, which I think goes back to his hope. Like you talk about this, his hope was not so much that evangelicalism per se wins. It's the strongest scholarship and the thickest and most robust orthodoxy with that strong scholarship. That's where at least the hope for some of this comes. But I mean, obviously found it first and foremost in Jesus. But yeah, Dr. Burnett, thank you for your work. It is a long book, so I'll warn people, this is a long book. It's like 550 pages of text and maybe 100 pages of notes. But there's, I mean, it's, even if you're not interested in Machen, which I think you should be interested in Machen, even if you're not, this is a fantastic work on just late 18th century, early 19th century kind of American culture. Like what are the currents moving around, and how does Machen deal with it? What's Protestant liberalism? What's conservatism? All these things that are going around in this area, and especially with Machen, because like Nick said, the OPC, Westminster Seminary, which they like, I think there's like two comments on them at the very end of the book. It's not necessarily the scope of the book, but that was Machen's response, was Westminster Seminary, and then the OPC a few years after that, which is where I'm at, and Nick is technically still at. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thanks for writing this, and I highly, highly, highly encourage people to pick up this book, read about Machen, and thank you for your work.
Thank you both. Appreciate you.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this week's book club episode, where we spotlight a specific book from a publisher and an author that both Nick and I really enjoy. We don't always agree with everything that the author or the book comes about, but what they do share with us is love for Christ and his gospel from whatever tradition they come from, whatever creedal tradition they come from or confessional tradition. We all do share the same broader ecumenical Christian faith, from different backgrounds, ethnicities, and denominations. We hope that these introduce books that you might not have heard of before, authors that you might not have heard of before. I've been really helped by learning about some of these. If you want to go to our show notes, find a link to the publisher, that helps them out a ton. A link to the author's page, to the book, to purchase it from the publisher themselves. It really helps them expose their work through the publisher themselves.
Yeah, and the value that we're bringing with these book clubs is you guys can really rely on us, because as we all know, it takes a lot of time and effort to stay on top of all the books that are coming out and know which ones are probably good to look into, be recommended to read, look out for. And so these episodes are to whet your palate. We've already know that we're going to recommend this book, but you can listen to the episode yourself, get a little more understanding of the book and the author, and then go from there.
Yeah. So if you want to find these books and purchase one for yourself, purchase one for friends or family, and also too, if you can find us on Apple, Spotify, any podcast catcher, rate and review us. That's how we're best known. It's how we kind of make ourselves known. Introduce these to a friend and maybe just build your bookcase, build your reading, read broader and read really well, all under the umbrella of our creedal faith under Jesus Christ.